Good morning. Good to see everyone. There's something I was going to say. I think what I was going to mention is that I think every week, I think people kind of keep moving farther away from me. And so I need to figure out if that's me, if that's you guys. And like I said, I think one of these days, I have to kind of do this every week. So eventually we're going to kind of make you guys move up closer to me. Apparently the only people who want to be close to me is my family. So I guess that's how it works. But we are going to, I think little by little over the next few months, we're going to kind of encourage you to come forward. And like I said, maybe one day I will show up on the back and I'll preach from there. I always threaten that, but I never do. We actually have a really difficult passage today. If you listen to the reading, we've been going through Job. We did 2 weeks in Job chapter 1. We skipped and we're now in Job chapter 3. And if you notice, it's not a very happy story. Matter of fact, it can be kind of depressing, right? I mean, Job has gone through this terrible tragedy that we'll line up in a few minutes. But what we see is what we saw wasn't even a prayer. You know, it's not that he's experienced hardship and now he's gotten on his knees and he's praying before God. It's not even a prayer. These are just kind of the things that are coming out of him, out of his heart. And what we see is that there's a lot of sadness. There's a lot of sorrow. And the reason why we need to address it is because, A, it is part of the story. I mean, this is really, you know, there's a realism to the scriptures because it tells us what's happening in people's lives. Matter of fact, if the scriptures didn't reflect a realistic point of view, we would never think that it was important, right? But the Bible speaks about very difficult moments in the human existence. And the other reason is because I think for us as a society, we've gotten to a place where we've become kind of fixated on this idea of clinical depression. And there's a couple things I need to say. We're not going to address it as a whole today as a sermon, but depression is a very important issue. I think it's a little kind of blown out of proportion now, but there are kind of biological, sometimes physiological elements to it, and sometimes we do need to go see professionals about that. But I think what we have to remember is not all sorrow or sadness is depression. Not all sorrow or sadness is something that you need to go and see a psychologist about. Matter of fact, I was reading this blog by this doctor, and he tells a story about a patient who came in, and he said, Doc, I mean, I've been sad for, how do I know if I need to see a psychologist or not? And the doctor simply asked him, has anything bad happened to you lately? And he said, well, yes, one of my friends did pass away. And he said, then it's okay, it's normal. I mean, you're supposed to be sad. You know, I think that's the degree to which we've gotten kind of caught up in this idea of depression and the issues of depression. There are times in life where sorrow and sadness are right. There are things that happen to us in life where the proper and good response is to be depressed. It is to be sad. It is to be sorrowful, whatever word you want to use for it. And the question that we have to ask is this. In those times where tragedy hits, where miseries take over, when I feel sad, when I feel sorrowful, how am I to understand those emotions? How am I to understand myself? And that's really the question that I wanted to answer today. And the amazing thing is that in the book of Job, we find answers. Now, in Job, we find a man who is a fellow sufferer with us. Now, a man who experiences great loss, and through his experience of suffering, we begin to see what our suffering, what our sorrow, what our sadness should look like. Just to give you kind of a review, if you have your Bible open, which I'd encourage you to do, we are going to be in chapter 3, but you can kind of flip through, go back to 1, and just kind of follow me. Basically, what we've seen is this. Job is a man who's living a good life, right? He has wonderful family, big family. He has wealth beyond measure. And he's an important man because of his wealth, because of he has a position. People respect him. We see this little moment where God meets and Satan asks to bring tragedy in his life and God allows it. And in one fell swoop or in multiple swoops, what Satan does is he takes away Job's children. He takes away his wealth, takes away his influence. And in chapter 2, he even takes away his health. In chapter 2, Satan comes back and afflicts Job with these terrible sores, with these boils on his body. And it's so bad, he's in so much pain and itching that all he can do is he goes to this place with ashes outside the city and he just begins to scrape himself to find some relief. And what we find in chapter 2 is everything has been taken away except his wife. His wife is only left. And you can say, well, Pastor Young, doesn't that say something about suffering, that everything's taken away except his wife? I would never say that. I would never say anything like that. But here's a man who's basically lost everything, right? And it's so bad that his wife comes and says, just curse God and die. I mean, that's how bad it's gotten. So not worth living anymore. And again, what we see in chapter 3 is we see this lament. We see the fact that he's pouring his heart out. It's not a prayer, but what he's doing is he's wishing that he was never born. You know, his life has become so terrible that he wishes he was never born. And we're kind of invited into this lament. When we look through it, we're going to see three things. First thing we're going to see is we're going to see the need for sorrow, that there is a sense in which sorrow is right and that it's important. Second thing we're going to see is there are limits. There are limits to sorrow. You know, that it's not just woe is me and we can say whatever we say. There are kind of limitations. There are boundaries that we need to be careful of. And the third thing that we see is that there is power in sorrow, that God is doing something even in the midst of our sadness, even in the midst of our depression. So the first thing is we see the need for sorrow. Go back to verses 1 through 6. And in verses 1 through 6, again, it opens up this kind of new movement within the story. And it says, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. Job said, let the day perish on which I was born, and the night that said, a man is conceived. Let that day be darkness. May God above not seek it, nor light shine upon it. Let gloom and darkness claim it. Let clouds dwell upon it. Let the blackness of the day terrify it. That night, let thick darkness seize it. Let it not rejoice among the days of the year. Let it not come into the number of the months. You know, what we see here is we see that again, Job has lost everything, even his health. He's experienced more tragedy than hopefully you and I ever will. And he's in a period of mourning. And he's lost his loved ones. He's lost his wealth. He's lost his position. He's lost his health. You know, his mortality is in front of him. And we see this sorrow. Matter of fact, you know, if Job experienced all this loss and, you know, on the other side said, I'm good, right? Then we would say, this is strange, right? I mean, someone who goes through this much loss, this much pain, I mean, you're supposed to be sad. You're supposed to mourn. You're supposed to feel bad. And, you know, believe it or not, Job reminds us that sorrow does have an important place in our lives. You know, it does have, it is instrumental. It is a part of our experience in this world. You know, in the illustration that I told you about the doctor, you know, what he was saying to his patient is there are good and proper reasons to be sad. There are good reasons to be mournful. There are good reasons to be sorrowful. There are good reasons to feel depressed. You know, if it's out of nowhere, that's a different thing. But there are good reasons why we should feel those things. And, you know, it reminds us in a very basic way that Christianity is not an emotionless religion. You know, it's not an ascetic religion that says, you know, that if you step in real spirituality or really knowing God or really understanding the world or really understanding life means that you're going to go through unhampered by the bad things in life. That's not what Christianity is. You know, what the Bible tells us again and again is it tells us that we are not promised happiness at every turn. You know, the Bible reminds us that even though we have salvation, salvation isn't this idea that God will make everything right. I mean, we see lots of situations in the Bible where people's lives don't turn out right. You know, we see people who are martyred. We see people who are persecuted. We see people who suffer. You know, we see all these things. And salvation doesn't mean that in this lifetime, everything is made good. And I think a lot of times we mistake that. You know, we think that that's kind of what Christianity means. Christianity means that, yeah, I'm going to go through some bad things, but in my lifetime, everything's going to come up roses at some point. And it doesn't. Sometimes sorrow stretches out. Sometimes bad things continue to happen. And you could say, well, if that's the case, why even become a Christian? I mean, the beauty of salvation, the beauty of redemption is that one day, even if it's not in this life, one day, everything will become right. And again, that isn't that everyone's going to have a happily ever after story, but at some point, God will make all things good. And that is much deeper than simply saying, during my lifetime, God will restore my wealth, God will restore my position, God will restore all the things that I've lost, God will even things out for me. I mean, it's so much fuller, so much more rich. Matter of fact, there's a lot of people who say this. They say, when you become a Christian, or the truth of the faith means that you are actually going to experience deeper sorrow than most people. And when you think about that, that makes sense. You know, as Christians, you and I, when we experience tragedies, we are going to feel a bigger brunt, a bigger source. We're going to feel more pain, more agony. You know, we're going to experience more sorrow, more sadness. And the reason why is because we know that there is a bigger picture. And the bigger picture is that whatever small tragedy we experience, whatever small difficulty we see, it's a part of a bigger story. And the greater story says that there is a greater tragedy going on. There's this wonderful quote that I wanted to read by Paul Tripp. And basically what he's saying is for you and I as Christians, we suffer more, we experience more loss, we experience more sorrow, we experience more difficulty because we live in a fallen world and we know where all of this comes from. He says this, he's speaking about death, but it has to do with basically, you know, our experience of sorrow and sadness. He says, in times of death, a Christian should be sadder than anyone else. We know how sin brought death into the world. We mourn not only for the loved one we have lost, but also for the fact that death continues to destroy. We live in a place where something that was never meant to be has become a common experience. We know how wonderful life on earth could have been. And you know, that's absolutely true. You know, when you become a Christian, it's not an insurance policy against the sad things that happen in life that, hey, you know, turn that frown upside down, God will make all things right, you know, God will make your life better. No. Now, Paul Tripp reminds us that as Christians, we actually feel it deeper, because we know that it touches on something bigger that we see about the world as we know it. That all the tragedies we experience come from a deeper thing, that we live in a place that is fallen, broken, and irredeemable. And that for you and I, we cannot escape. There's a normality to it, and it is inescapable. At the same time, as believers, he does remind us that there is joy in the midst of that sorrow, that one day God will make those things right. But there is a sorrow, right? There is a sense of sadness. There is a sense in which we look at the things that are around us and we say, it's broken. And so if that's the case, sorrow has a necessary place in our lives. It is right and it is God-honoring to be saddened by the bad things that happen around us. The reason why I say that is because I think a lot of times, especially for us as Christians, those are the things that we hide. Those are the things we bottle up. I've been in the church ever since I was about 6 years old. I became a believer when I was 20, but I essentially grew up in the church, and I've seen a lot of scenarios, a lot of situations where people had horrific things going on in their lives, and yet they came into church with a smile on their face. People would ask them how they were doing, never let on. And on the outside, it looked good, but it wasn't. And you know, there's something deeply destructive about that. I don't know if you've ever done that yourself or if you've seen people do that. You know, when you bottle up your sorrow, it becomes emotionally, it becomes spiritually, and it becomes socially destructive. Right? It just begins to explode in all these places in your life. I mean, you begin to bottle those things up, and what happens? I mean, a resentment grows, a bitterness grows. You bottle those things up, what happens? The only way you can is you begin to disconnect yourself from your feelings. You begin to put on a smile, but it's fake. And after a while, if you do it long enough, you end up disconnecting yourself from that. You know, that's actually a very dangerous thing. You know, all of a sudden you stop feeling the right emotions at the right times. You stop being able to peer into your own heart and understand yourself. But spiritually, you end up pushing God away and you begin to push people away. You keep people at arm's length and no one ever gets to peer in. And you know, I've seen that happen a lot. You know, what's interesting is in Job doesn't end up, at the end of this chapter, he doesn't bottle it up. He doesn't end up alone. That's a lot of times what happens. You bottle up, you hold it in, and you end up all by yourself. Job expresses his sorrow. He says what he has to say. And what we see is it allows his friends to come near to him. And that's actually what the rest of the book is about up until about chapter 40. From chapter 4 to chapter 40, essentially it's him interacting with his friends. It's his friends saying, I think this is what's happening to you. This is what you need to do. Here's what's going on. This is what God's trying to teach you. And he kind of speaks back to them. But it's interesting that Job is able to express sorrow, and that allows his friends, that allows people to come into his life. It allows people to talk to him. It allows people to interact with him. It allows people to suffer with him. It allows friends to come by and to be a part of his life. But when we hold it in, when we bottle it up, it ends up pushing everyone and everything out. Sorrow is absolutely needed. It's a normal part of life, and it's something that at certain times it's the godly good answer for bad things. Second thing we see is that there are limits to sorrow. In other words, just the fact that sorrow is good doesn't mean you can go do whatever you want. You can punch people, you can scream at God, you can do all these things. We do see that there are limitations to it. In other words, just because it's okay for Job to express this sorrow, there is a line. You know, there is a line where sorrow goes from healthy to unhealthy. You know, there is a line where sorrow and sadness goes from being from being good to being sinful, right? And we see some of that line in here. You know, Job experiences and he expresses this deep sorrow. And what we see is there's essentially two lines that he never crosses. You know, in verse 1, it says, after this, you know, after all these things happened, it says, after this, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. We notice two things about these limitations or these lines that are drawn in the sand. One of them is, in his sorrow, he never blames God. And that's very, very interesting. Chapter 2, verse 10, it says, Job is speaking to his wife, he says, but he said to her, you speak as one of the foolish women would speak. Shall we receive good from God, and shall we not receive evil? In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. If you notice, there's a line that Job understands, and one of the lines is, God is never to blame. And that sounds like a false dichotomy to make. And it's very unusual because Job never questions God's goodness. He never questions God's character. He never questions what God is doing, never denounces God, never demeans God. What he does is in this lament, he curses the day of his birth, right? He doesn't shake his fist at God and say, God, how dare you? Why did you do this to me, right? And the reason why it's unusual is because I think that is our first reaction, isn't it? Bad things happen, and that's our first kind of reaction is, God, how could you, why is this happening? How could you let this happen to me? Now, we immediately go to that. And for Job, he doesn't do that. He doesn't blame God. That isn't his first reaction. Job recognizes that God is sovereign, that he oversees all of it, but he also understands that God is not always the direct cause of everything. And there's a very big difference between those two. Again, Job doesn't know what's happening. We do. Job knows that Satan has come before God and he's asked to do these things and Satan has put his hand on him and this evil and the suffering that's happened is because of Satan, not God. And I think that's an important distinction to make. The Bible tells us again and again that God is not the author of evil, that God is not the source of our suffering. And so if that's true, it means that there is a line that's there, and the line is that in our lament, in our sorrow, in our sadness, God is not to blame for those things. And again, you could say, well, that's kind of an easy way out of viewing this. You know, doesn't God's sovereignty mean he's responsible? Again, he is sovereign. But at the same time, we see that he's not to blame. And one of the great stories that I read is James Dobson talks about this. He said how, for those of you who don't know James Dobson, he is a very important Christian leader a long time ago. He ran Focus on the Family for a long time. And he really built his place on counseling and family. And one day on the air, he read a story that a girl had written to him, teenage girl. She wrote to him, and she basically, the story was that she and her boyfriend had been getting closer and closer in their relationship. They'd slept together, and she just found out that she was pregnant. And in her letter, her question was this. She said, "Mr. Dobson, why would God do this to us?" And you know, it was one of those moments where even hearing it, you go, you want to take this girl aside and say, "God didn't do this. Not God's fault. I mean, God didn't. There's no way in which God twisted your arm and, you know, made these things happen, right?" I mean, there's a difference. God is sovereign, but it doesn't mean that he twists the arms of everyone and everything around you. Bible tells us again that, you know, that it's very clear that God is not the source of the evil that's in this world, the evil that surrounds us, or the suffering that we experience. And that's a very, very important line for us to remember. We blame God, and it's based on this secret belief. I think it's a belief. It can be rooted in a couple beliefs, but I think one of the things it can be rooted in is it can be rooted in the secret belief that somehow God is supposed to make our lives better. God is supposed to make our lives easier, and when it's not, we blame God. Or it's rooted in this belief that we deserve better, and so when we don't get it, God is somehow screwing with the results. Now, Job expresses this deep sorrow, but he knows he never blames God. And that is one bright line. I think the other one that is implied through a lot of the stuff that's happening here is Job never considers taking his own life. There's this kind of moment where Satan afflicts Job, and Job's wife comes and says, "Curse God and die." And that kind of leads to some other questions, but I think it kind of bears that that this is kind of a good, important thing to address, partly because in our society, you know, there's such a sensitivity to that, you know, to this idea of taking your own life. I remember there was a big thing, what was it, a year ago or 2 years ago, when Netflix put out that show, 13 Reasons Why. You know, there's a really popular Broadway musical called Dear Evan Hansen that you know, taking your life is kind of one, it's a part of the plot or part of the story. It's kind of one of the plot elements that pushes a story along. And you know, even in the news yesterday, there's a TSA worker down in Miami who leapt to his death at the airport, shut down, you know, the airport completely. And so we see that, you know, this idea of taking your life is not just an issue for teenagers, you know, vulnerable teens. It's also something for adults. And it's easy to think that that's an easy way out. You know, in the midst of suffering, in the midst of sorrow, what sorrow does, what depression does, what sadness does is if it extends out, it can actually begin to distort. It distorts our thinking. It distorts our perspective. Matter of fact, if you go back and if you read Job chapter 4 all the way up to Job chapter 40, you actually begin to notice that Job is actually little by little, as his sorrow continues, as he continues to experience this sadness in his life, this mourning in his life, you begin to see that he becomes distorted. He doesn't get to the full place where he blames God and shakes his fist, but as the story goes on, you begin to notice he starts getting angry. He starts asking tougher questions. He starts demanding things of God. And it's a very interesting shift that's happening in his life. It never gets to the point where he screams at God and rejects God and does that, but we see this fact that he's becoming more disturbed, that he's becoming more distorted. You know, that's one of the dangers that we see in prolonged sadness and prolonged suffering and prolonged sorrow. You know, is we begin to become distorted. Our perspective, our thought process, and if we're not careful, it can cause us, or we can begin to ignore basic beliefs about God's love and about God's gift of life. You know, there are limits to our expressions of sorrow, and there should be, because there are ways in which we can express sorrow that are oriented towards God, and there's ways in which we can express sorrow and sadness that are not oriented to God. And Job continually expresses sorrow, but it's still rooted in his faith and his belief. Third thing that I want to address is that there is power in sorrow. If you go down to verses 20 through 26, there's these questions that Job begins to ask. In verse 20, he says, "Why is light given to him who is in misery and life to the bitter in soul?" If you go down to verse 23, he says, "Why is light given to a man whose ways are hidden, whom God has hedged in?" Like I said, in a lot of ways, what sorrow can do is sorrow can distort us. It can distort our perspective, can distort our thinking. It can close us off to others. It can close us off to God. What we see through the story of Job, though, is sorrow also has the power to drive us, to push us. And what's interesting is this. Job experiences great tragedy, again, more than most of us ever will. But he begins to ask questions. And I want you to notice, like, it's really hard to figure out what he's asking, right? Verse 20 says, "Why is light given to him who's in misery?" 23, "Why is light given to a man whose way is hidden?" And basically, here's what he's asking. You know, translate that into our English, and he's saying, why does God give life to people who experience misery and tragedy? Now, if you notice, he's not denouncing God, he's not denying God, he's not angry at God, but he has a question. Saying, God, if things are difficult, if life is hard, why do you give us life? Wouldn't it be better that you just shut everything down? Right? And that's a very important question. God, if you know that we are going to suffer greatly, then why do you even give us life? You know what? What begins to happen from this point on in the book of Job is this. Job begins to ask this and a couple of other questions. And it's these types of questions that begin to drive him towards God. And you know, that's actually a very unique thing. Like I said, there is a way in which sorrow and sadness can push you away from God. You can become angry at God. You can shake your fist at him. You could say, why is this happening to me? You could say, God, this is unjust. How dare you? But what Job does is he begins to ask these bigger questions, and these bigger questions make him realize that only God can answer that. And so he begins to move towards God. He has to figure this out. Matter of fact, you know, when you continue to read through those 35 chapters in Job from 4 out to 40, Job becomes more and more maniacal, more and more obsessed with this idea of standing before God and asking him these questions. By the middle and towards the end of the book, he starts realizing that God is the only one who will ever give him a straight answer, that the only way he will ever figure out the deep things of life is to stand before God and say, God, why is it like this? But you know, it's amazing to see that what sorrow has done is it hasn't pushed him away from God, it's actually pushed him towards God. And you know, for most of us, we wouldn't even imagine that it could do that. Because for most of us, our experience of sorrow causes us to question God, not want to ask God questions. And those are two different things. You know, what Job does is he begins to become restless because he wants to ask God these questions. He has to find them out. And he knows that the only way to figure it out is if he were able to stand before God and ask. And that becomes his desire. Stand before God, ask him. Again, for most of us, sorrow leads to avoiding God. It leads to running away from God. It leads us to avoid people, to run away from other people too. But sorrow also has the power, a unique power to push you towards God. It can push you away from God. You can get angry. You can blame. Or it can push you towards God. Now, it can push you towards God by realizing he's the only one that can help. He's the only one that can answer. And that's not saying that in your sorrow you're going to get to do this like Job. Job does get to stand before God face to face. Job does get to question God face to face. And that's not saying that, again, if you do it right, you'll get a chance to do that. I would actually suggest, if you do it right, I would suggest you don't want to do that. And we'll see that at the end, that when you stand before God, it's not a fun thing. You know, what I am saying, though, is I am saying that even your sorrow can cause you to love and adore him more. Even your sadness can cause you to trust and rely on God more. And that sounds impossible right now. The thing I wanted to end with is this. There is another power that sorrow has, and it's not brought up here, but we do see it in the New Testament. Sorrow also has another power. And the other power it has, it, like I mentioned here, in a generic way, it leads us to God. It can point us to God. It can remind us of the love of God. It can show us that we need to rely on God because he has answers, because only he can fix things. It has another power. Not only can it draw us to God in a generic sense, it can also help lead us to Christ in a very particular sense. One of the beautiful things about suffering and sorrow is Christianity addresses it differently than any other religion. Other religions want to avoid it. Other religions say if you really do love God, he'll take it out of your life. Christianity is the only religion that says at the heart of your faith, you have a God who suffered too. In Christianity says you have a God who has experienced great sorrow too. Now, one of the amazing things is if you look at Jesus experienced sorrow all throughout his life. Remember, he wasn't just a man, a teacher who went around and said, hey, you know, you be healed. Let me tell you about what this means. He went around and he was a savior who wept. Remember, his friends came to him and said, Lazarus has died. And if you remember, what did he do? He wept. No other religion speaks of a God who cries. But Christianity does. Now, Jesus looked out on the people of Jerusalem and he wept for them. Why? Because they were like sheep without a shepherd. And you know, when Jesus was on the cross, he experienced the deepest sorrow of sorrows. He looked up to the heavens and he said, my God, why have you forsaken me? And if you notice, in that sorrow, he never cursed God, never blamed God. He asked why. But you and I know why, don't we? We know that Jesus was allowed to experience the deepest sorrow of sorrows because in his sorrow, he would be able to rescue us from our sorrows. For you and I, one of the deepest powers that sorrow has is it shows us that we cannot handle life, tragedy, we cannot handle the problems and the miseries of life. Sorrow shows us that we are incapable of dealing with human existence. And so our sorrows point us to another, one in which his sorrows became joy. And when you know that Jesus did that for you, when you know that Jesus didn't just grit his teeth and get through the execution, but when you know that he suffered and he took in the sorrows, that he mourned and that he wept and that his heart was moved and that he was anguished through the terrible things that he experienced, when you realize that he did all those things for you, then you and your sorrows find help and you find hope. When you see that he has experienced the deepest of sorrows that anyone could ever experience, then in your sorrows, you find yourself running to him. Let's pray.